It's an oratorio in Montreal. I think it's the second largest one in the world. It's set on a hill, at the top of a hill. And there's a huge staircase leading up to it from the bottom of the hill. And people often who are crippled and who are on crutches and so forth or in wheelchairs go there and make their way painfully up the hill. Or maybe they do that on their knees. And the idea is that they're struggling incrementally uphill, step by step, despite their burdens, to reach the city of God on the hill. And they're acting out. That's life. It's like the proper aim is the city of God on the hill. And what is that? Well, that's that place where these levels of responsibility are stacked together harmoniously so that you're acting in your best interest and in your family's best interest and in the world's best interest. And I would say in the best interests of reality itself, right? Assuming that we have some integral role to play in reality, which is certainly at least true at the human level. That's the city of God on the hill that beckons to everyone. And you move towards that humbly. So that's one step at a time. And you do it despite your burden and your suffering, all of that. And that's all dramatized in that. And it's a perfect drama of that. My granddaughter, who's 14 months old, has just learned a new game. And the game is she plays it with her wooden spoon. And the game is she has the spoon, and then she looks at you, and then she gives you the spoon. And then you take it from her, and she lets it go, and then she watches you, and then you give the spoon back. And she's very happy to get the spoon back. She's also very happy to give it to you. And then she turns to the next person, and she gives them the spoon, and then she gets it back. And then you can play with her. And the play is, well, now you've started to embody the principle of reciprocity, right? We can trade. And it's a repeating game. It's not one trade. You don't end up with the spoon, and I don't end up with the spoon. We both have the spoon some of the time across time. And there's some utility in the exchange itself. Okay, so she's playing with that and thrilled about it. And no wonder, because it's a walloping, walloping discovery. And so then you take the spoon from her, and maybe you hold it a little longer than she expects, and that makes her a little nervous, but then you give it back, and then she's relieved, and that makes her happy. Or you cover the spoon with your hand, and then she's a bit confused about where it might be, and you show it to her, and you give it back, and she's happy about that. Or she reaches out to grab it, and you pull it away a little bit, and move it back and forth, so she has to do a little more effort to get it. And as long as you don't push that, and it's a bit of a challenge to her, both physically in terms of coordination, but also psychologically in terms of delay of gratification, she also finds that gratifying. And the reason for that is that you're showing how robust and resilient the idea of reciprocity is across sequences of transformations. And so the Piagetian idea is something like, there's an implicit morality that emerges to constrain the infinite set of interpretations, and it has to do with the structure that will maintain reciprocity optimally in the largest, including the largest number of people across the largest amount of time. And so the way that I've been portraying that for the people who've been listening to my lectures is that, well, you need to take responsibility for yourself, as if you care for yourself. Okay, so first we figure out what's yourself. Well, it's not just you now, because you aren't just you now. You're the community of yous that stretch across time. So in order for you to take care of yourself properly now, you have to learn to play an iterative game with yourself that's sustainable and even potentially improvable across time. And there aren't many games that you can play like that, so that starts to radically constrain the set of possibilities. And then it's more constrained than that, because not only do you have to play a game with yourself that can repeat across time to minimize suffering, to remove the possibility of death, to allow for the possibility of productive movement and a certain amount of happiness, but you have to do that with other people around you and across time. And so there's you and the multiple yous embedded in your family and the multiplicity of your family members embedded inside a culture and the extension of that culture across time. And so for you to act properly, then all of those things have to be harmoniously balanced at the same time. And that radically reduces the set of potential interpretations. And that's the antidote to the chaos of the infinite array of potential perceptual worlds. Well, and then there are questions that emerge out of that, like, well, what's the best way to play that game? But we certainly know that reciprocity, fair play, the spirit of fair play is immensely important to that, and that's what Piaget documented, and it's what we all know, and also that there's something about truth that's absolutely integral to that as well. one of the things I talk about in 12 Rules for Life, and this is, and in my lectures, this has become a meme, strangely enough, something that's widely distributed on the web, partly because there's a comical element to it. It's to clean up your room. And everyone laughs about that because I'm taking that seriously. It's like, well, clean up your room. Everyone's mother has told them that 1,000 times, right? But I try to explain why. It's like, well, you have a bit of chaotic potential right in front of you. It's in some sense infinite in its potential. And the domain in which you can manipulate that might be rather restricted because of the restrictions that are part and parcel of your existence. But maybe you have your room, and you might think, you might have contempt for that, and so it's a complete bloody catastrophe. But you don't have to. You could think, well, it isn't a room, it's a place of potential. And as soon as you know that, then it's not your room anymore. It isn't a room. The room that you see is your preconception of the space that you inhabit. What's there is a fragment of infinity. That's what's there. And what you see is the low resolution consequence of your assumption and lazy habit and blindness. That's your initial room. And you think, well, no, that's not the room. See, part of what artists do, for example, when Van Gogh paints a room and you look at it glowing, he's trying to show you what's beyond your perception of the room. And I mean this technically, like the way that your visual system is set up is that whenever memory and presumption can replace direct perception, it will, because it's simpler. So you literally see what you expect to see. And if what you see is dull and drab and boring and pointless and uninspiring, then that's you. It's not what's there. And what the artist does when he or she re-represents that mundane reality is to remind you of what's behind it, the potential that's there. And so what I'm suggesting to people is that they take the potential that's right in front of them. It's like, okay, and here's the rule. You're aiming up. There's something that you could change, that you would change. That might be a very small thing. Could, well, that's within the grasp of your power. Would is within the grasp of your will. To combine those two things might be a very small shift. You might only be willing to make a very tiny step forward. It's like, fine, good enough. Make a tiny step forward. And that makes you a slight bit stronger than you were before. And then the next step can be slightly larger. And it's the path of humility. What human beings confront in their lives is akin to what God himself confronted at the beginning of time. And so it's easy for us to believe that we're deterministic creatures like clocks. And that it's the past that drives us forward in a deterministic manner into the future. But I don't believe that's the case. I actually don't think there's any evidence that that's the case, because people are so complex you actually can't predict them as if they're deterministic, except in very constrained circumstances. And so it's a hypothesis, but it's not a very good one. What seems to me to be the case, and I think this is how people conceptualize themselves and how they act towards themselves and towards other people and how our social structures, our political structures are constituted, is that human beings constantly confront a landscape of possibility. It's potential itself. And we have a belief in the idea of potential. We have an idea that there are things that could be. It's a very strange conception of reality, because it's not a materialistic conception, because things that could be aren't measurable in any sense, right? But we certainly act as if they exist. And we all treat each other as if one of our fundamental ethical requirements is for you to confront that potential properly, and that would be to live up to your responsibility. Because you have these gifts and talents and possibilities that have been granted to you, and if you fail to make use of them, your talents, let's say, then that's a sin of sorts. And that's a religious way of thinking about it, but it doesn't matter, because that's how people treat each other. If you have a child, for example, or a spouse, or a friend, brother, anyone you care about, and you see, you have the intuition that they could be making more of themselves and what they have than they are, then you're deeply disappointed in that. And the reason you're disappointed in that is because there's a call to us, an existential call, to confront that potential that's everywhere, that faces us in every direction, and to transform it into the most functional and habitable order possible. And the way that that is to be done properly is with truth.